If you've been anywhere near a radio this week, television set, even Facebook, you surely know the U.S. Supreme Court has once again returned to the nation's spotlight as the bench considers the constitutionality of gay marriage. Good morning. I'm Steve Brown, and welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm sitting in for Ann again today. This hour, we're talking about gay marriage and arguments challenging California's ban and the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, that phone number is 614-292-8513. You can also email the program at allsides@wosu.org. You can send us a note on Facebook. You can also tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. We know this is a controversial topic, but please, this segment, we're trying to keep our questions to Supreme Court arguments and policy only. Joining us now to discuss these Supreme Court cases is Mark Spindleman. He's a professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Welcome back to the program, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, listeners, send your questions or comments to 614-292-8513. Mark Spindleman, as usual, little with the Supreme Court is simple. These are both complicated and nuanced cases. I want to start with a soundbite from Tuesday's arguments regarding California's Proposition 8. Here's Justice Sonia Sotomayor questioning Charles Cooper, the attorney arguing in support of Proposition 8.
Outside of the marriage context, can you think of any other rational basis, reason, for a state using sexual orientation as a factor in denying homosexuals benefits or imposing burdens on them? Is there any other rational decision-making that the government could make? Denying them a job, not granting them benefits of some sort, any other decision?
Your Honor, I cannot.
And that gets right to the heart of just how unique and precedent-setting all of this is. So, Mark Spindleman, sticking with Tuesday's arguments and the fight over Proposition 8 for now, help us understand the real arguments being made here, what each side is trying to argue.
Sure. So just a little bit of background about Proposition 8. Proposition 8 is an amendment to the California Constitution that prohibits same-sex couples from getting married under state law. What's unique or distinctive about that amendment to the Constitution, although we have one that does something similar.
Right, passed 2004.
Yep, in Ohio. In the state of California, the California Supreme Court, prior to the enactment of Proposition 8, had said that same-sex couples had a constitutional right to marry under the state's law. And there was also state law on the books that had given lesbian and gay couples a full panoply of rights and benefits that were like the same rights and benefits that heterosexual married couples received. So what the effect of Proposition 8 is to do is to make it so that same-sex couples may not get the name marriage for their relationships that are legally recognized by the state, but that otherwise they have all the same rights, benefits, and protections, as well as the same obligations as straight married couples do.
And that's been a big argument by the supporters of Proposition 8, that the opponents really only care about the title.
Yeah. And so the question is, having come that far, why is it rational to withhold the name of marriage from same-sex couples? And that's the direction in which Justice Sotomayor's question, as well as a number of the other questions during oral arguments on Tuesday, went.
In this case that was heard on Tuesday, brought by a lesbian couple who claim they were relegated to essentially second-class status by being denied a marriage license, and a California court basically agreed, saying Proposition 8 violated the state's version of the Equal Protection Clause. The Supreme Court could uphold the ruling, they could overturn it, they could limit it to the state of California. They could find, conceivably, all of the state's bans on gay marriage are illegal, or they could punt. There's a bunch of different things they could do here.
Yeah, big range of questions. One of the things that came through pretty clearly on Tuesday was that the Supreme Court justices are actively considering the possibility that maybe they shouldn't reach a judgment on what are referred to as the merits of the case, on the underlying constitutional question of whether Proposition 8 violates the Constitution, but rather should perhaps decide this on more technical legal grounds, that the folks who were defending Proposition 8 in state court, who were not state lawyers, they were not representatives of the state itself, but the proponents of Proposition 8, whether they have standing to appeal the loss in the trial court, which said that there is a constitutional right to same-sex marriage that Proposition 8 violates in different ways.
And the proponents of Proposition 8 had to defend this case because Democratic California Governor Jerry Brown declined, said the state would not defend the law.
Yeah, it's a unique situation in which the state defendants believe that the Proposition 8 is unconstitutional, and so we're not actively defending, and certainly not actively defending on appeal. And so the defendant interveners, the proponents of Proposition 8, came in and were standing in the shoes of the state. A question was posed to the California Supreme Court during the very complex proceedings in the litigation. Do the folks who are proponents of Prop 8 have standing? Are they the right parties to bring a defense of Proposition 8 in the state courts? The California Supreme Court said yes. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the decision that's now on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, said it turns out that that not only do the proponents of Proposition 8 have standing to appeal the judgment against Proposition 8 in the Ninth Circuit and in the state courts, but also in the federal courts.
And have you seen anything like this?
It's very unusual. It's very unusual for the state to say we think that this measure is unconstitutional and not defend it at all. It's happened in a different way. We can talk about it in the context of the Defense of Marriage Act. These proceedings are nothing if not out of the ordinary, and in that sense, they're extraordinary.
And you say that there were some justices on the bench, specifically Justice Kennedy, who wanted to stay focused on the technical issues, but justices such as Justice Scalia were really interested in answering more of the big picture, getting to the root of the root of the whole matter. And I think his exact phrase was, "We've crossed that bridge. We've granted cert. Now we have to decide."
Yeah, amazingly, during the oral arguments on Tuesday, Justice Kennedy seemed to say at one point along the way, "Maybe we shouldn't have agreed to hear this case." There may be other justices who agree with that possibility, but Justice Kennedy whose views in this case are distinctively important because he's regarded as the so-called swing justice on the court. Those views may be quite important, but it's also quite significant that it's not only the so-called liberals on the court who are ready to, if they are, reach the merits of the case and decide that there's a constitutional right to marry or not. But on the other side of the bench, Justice Kennedy, exactly as you say, raised the prospect that, you know, we really ought to get to the merits on this case. And we've already crossed the bridge of deciding whether we will hear it or not.
Right. And here in Ohio, something everybody has been concerned with, how could, speaking to the Proposition 8 argument specifically, how could this affect Ohio and the 2004 constitutional amendment that passed, I believe a margin of 62-38. It was pretty overwhelming. It was a landslide victory. How could the proposition arguments and the subsequent ruling affect our ban on gay marriage?
Yep. So both cases have the potential to affect the constitutionality of Ohio's marriage ban. It's all in how the court decides to decide the case. So, for instance, if the Supreme Court reaches a decision that was like the trial court decision in the case and holds that there's either a fundamental right to marry that includes same-sex marriage or that prohibitions on same-sex marriage violate considerations or constitutional concerns of equality or equal protection, then that kind of ruling could clearly have implications in some subsequent litigation for the constitutionality of Ohio's marriage ban, which not only which goes farther than California's, of course. In Ohio, it's not simply the case that Ohio's marriage ban in the Constitution prohibits same-sex couples from getting everything but marriage. Not only it prohibits same-sex marriage, and it prohibits, according to the Ohio Supreme Court, the legal the full legal equivalent of civil marriage, something like a civil union that would give same-sex couples all the same rights, benefits, and protections. So we can't have either same-sex marriage or the full legal equivalent like civil unions in Ohio.
Aside from the comments from Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia, any other hints on how the court might be leaning?
It's really interesting. I mean, before oral arguments took place this week, there were many who I think had quite high hopes that some of the courts, the folks who are people regard as the liberals on the bench, might be prepared to reach the merits and recognize that California's Proposition 8 is unconstitutional. What's interesting, telling, and important development is that a number of the justices who many think of as the liberal justices on the court seemed to be deeply, deeply concerned about whether there was standing to appeal the decision adverse to Proposition 8. That is, whether the case should be decided on the legal technicalities or whether it was really time to reach the merits of the case.
We're talking about gay marriage and the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. We're joined by Mark Spindelman. He's a professor at OSU's Moritz College of Law. Join the discussion. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email the program allsides@wosu.org. You can send us a note on Facebook, or you can tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. And again, we know many of you have very strong feelings on the issue of gay marriage, but we're trying to keep our discussion focused on the Supreme Court arguments and actual policy. And the U.S. Supreme Court never taken up the issue of gay marriage before. This It's an enormous buildup to this case, could have wide-ranging impacts again.
Yeah, so technically, the Supreme Court, exactly as you say, has never had big arguments like this in a major, major case. Although, as the oral arguments pointed out, there was a case that came before the court a number of years ago involving the constitutionality of excluding same-sex couples from marriage. And back then, the Supreme Court said, this doesn't even raise a serious federal question at all. It just shows how far we've come from those days where there wasn't even a serious argument to be made. If I could just quickly make the point, going back to the clip from Justice Sotomayor. So the question of whether there's a rational basis to discriminate against lesbians and gay men, including in the context of marriage, as a question that she was posing, seeming to suggest that there really isn't a rational basis for it, just shows again how far it is that we've traveled, even in constitutional terms, from the days back in, say, 1980. When the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of state sodomy bans on the grounds that criminalizing homosexual conduct simply for the reason of traditional morality stated an adequate or a legitimate or a rational governmental reason. We're very, very, very far from those days at this point in time.
Right, and the polling indicates that as well. Charles Cooper, the man we met in the first soundbite at the beginning of the program, went to great lengths to say same-sex marriage would not necessarily harm the institution of marriage, but might not advance it. But he seemed to have a hard time when he was asked by Justice Breyer about the institution of marriage being a means to further procreation. Let's listen to that.
What precisely is the way in which allowing gay couples to marry would interfere with the vision of marriage as procreation of children that allowing sterile couples of different sexes to marry would not? I mean, there are lots of people who get married who can't have children. And so take a state that does allow adoption and say, what's the justification for saying no gay marriage? Certainly not the one you said, is it? Am I not clear? Look, you said that the problem is marriage as an institution that furthers procreation.
Yes, sir.
And the reason there was adoption. But that doesn't apply to California. So imagine I wall off California and I'm looking just there where you say that doesn't apply. Now, what happens to your argument about the institution of marriage as a tool towards procreation, given the fact that in California, too, couples that aren't gay but can't have children get married all the time?
Yes, Your Honor. The concern is that redefining marriage as a genderless institution will sever its abiding connection to its historic traditional procreative purposes, and it will refocus the purpose of marriage and the definition of marriage away from the raising of children and to the emotional needs and desires of adults.
And again, that's Attorney Charles Cooper, the counsel representing supporters of Proposition 8, answering a question from Justice Breyer. And I really do wish we had more time to spend on Proposition 8. We could spend the whole entire program on it. But I want to lay out the arguments for DOMA, for and against DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and this before we go to break here. So it was passed by Congress in 1996. It bars federal recognition of same-sex marriage. And that prevents same-sex couples from receiving tax breaks, some pension benefits, some other benefits that are allowed to married people. The challenge is brought by a woman who had to pay $350,000 in estate taxes after her partner died, and she argues that those taxes would not have been required if she had a traditional marriage, and the legal claim centers around the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So Mark Spindelman from OSU's Moritz College of Law, There are also questions about legal standing in this case, because the Obama administration, just like the California administration, has declined to defend the law.
Yeah, so they actually turn out to think that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional as a violation of equality concerns applicable against the federal government, just as you say, through the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause. So it's a remarkable situation, very unusual, got a lot of play during oral arguments. What's the injury, the question was, that allows the administration, the United States government here, the administration representing the United States government, to come in and complain about the judgment in the Second Circuit when they actually think that the judgment in the Second Circuit, the Court of Appeals, was correct, that that struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act on constitutional grounds. Highly unusual, really an important development.
And both of these cases would likely be very different if California had a Republican governor or if we had a Republican president.
Yeah, it could easily be the case that you could imagine different administrations reaching different conclusions about the constitutionality of the measures.
Right, and we do have a call about DOMA. Joan calling from Delaware. Joan, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
My question is, if the Supreme Court does overturn DOMA, but limits it to the states that recognize marriage right now, if you were a resident of Ohio and you went to one of those states, and got married, would you get the federal benefits, even though you wouldn't get the state benefits because of our Constitution?
Is there a clear answer to that, Mark?
I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a law professor, and I'm not prepared to give any legal advice on that. But let me just speak to the general question. So the way that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act operates is to ordinarily prohibit the federal recognition of any same-sex marriages. If the Supreme Court strikes down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, it raises exactly the questions that the caller is describing about what happens. So ordinarily, it would be the case that that federal recognition of marriages would follow state law. But there are complicated questions. What happens if you happen to live in a state where marriage is not recognized, but then go to another state where it is, and then maybe move back to the state that you originally lived in, where it's not recognized? At that point, does the federal government recognize it? What will likely happen is, depending on what position the federal government takes in those cases, how it interprets the ruling of the Supreme Court, either may answer some of those questions, or there may be further litigation to clarify the meaning and scope of the Supreme Court's decision if it decides to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. Again, it depends on the grounds that the Supreme Court rules on.
Could it rule it narrowly in saying that Social Security benefits would be available to all legally married couples?
It's a great follow-up question. So I don't know that the arguments in the case are framed as strategically or tactically in relation to very particular kinds of governmental benefits. The question was being argued before the court is the broad question, or the relatively broader question, of whether the federal government may or must recognize same-sex marriage, or can discriminate between same-sex and cross-sex marriages for purposes of federal law, but not with that particular kind of granularity that your question reflects. Very, very, very astutely.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for the call, Joan. We're talking about gay marriage and the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. We're joined by Mark Spindleman, a professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. The phone lines are filling up. Stay tuned. Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by one of the nation's leading opponents of same-sex marriage. That's just ahead here on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming online at WOSU.org/allsides.
It's been an action-packed week for the Supreme Court as the 9 justices held hearings on California's Prop 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act. While we wait for rulings, we wonder what we learned and where does the fight go from here. I'm Celeste Headlee. NPR's Nina Totenberg explains the legal arguments, plus human cannonball Ileana Grace. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4. It's 38 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies today, a high of 48. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 30. And mostly sunny with a high near 50 for Friday. Support comes from ARC Industries, creating employment opportunities for people with disabilities and helping businesses grow their own inclusive workforce. ARC is dedicated to the success of its customers and employees and believes our community is at its best when we are all working together. Online at arcind.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann. We're talking about this week's Supreme Court arguments on gay marriage. We're still joined by Mark Spindleman from Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. We're waiting for John Eastman. He's the chairman of the board of the National Organization for Marriage. That's a group that opposes same-sex marriage. We'll let you know as soon as we get him on the line. But we'll continue our discussion right now with Mark Spindleman from Ohio State. Before we jump back into this, Mark, I do want to play another soundbite from Justice Ginsburg, where she was talking about just how pervasive the term marriage is in federal law.
They're not a question of additional benefits. I mean, they touch every aspect of life. Your partner is sick. Social Security. I mean, it's pervasive. It's not as though, well, there's this little federal sphere and it's only in a tax question. It's as Justice Kennedy said, 1,100 statutes, and it affects every area of life. And so you were really diminishing what the state has said is marriage. You're saying, no, state, there are two kinds of marriages, the full marriage and then the sort of skim milk marriage.
Skim milk marriage? I've never heard that term before, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg there. Mark Spindleman, is that fair? Do domestic partnerships and same-sex marriages vary that much?
So part of what Justice Ginsburg's point is to present a very important perspective on the impact of denying same-sex couples the right to marry, with the consequence, given the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, that those marriages will not be recognized as a matter of federal law. Under those circumstances, what I take it Justice Ginsburg is saying is that the state definition of marriage has lots of consequences that extend far beyond the boundaries of the state. So what it means to be married is not just what it means to be married for purposes of state law, but what it means to be married is to be married both for purposes of state law and federal law, so that when the federal government decides not to recognize state-recognized same-sex marriages, it makes those non-recognized state marriages seem less than in not just symbolic ways, but concrete and pervasive ways as she was describing it. This is a view that's in contrast to, I think, the view on the other side of the case, which sees a kind of much brighter distinction to be drawn between state benefits of marriage and federal benefits, where the idea is that the federal government, as a separate and distinct sovereign entity in our country, doesn't simply have to track the state definitions of marriage. It can have its own definition for its own sorts of purposes.
And we do have a caller on the line, Demsis from Grove City. I hope I pronounced that right. Demsis, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Other than the divisive social and moral issue of same-sex marriage, I'm just trying to understand what it seems like the whole issue is more of a financial equality type aspect and why so many people are opposed to providing equal benefits, financial benefits for those of the same sex. Is it more of a tax issue or what exactly is the argument against that?
Mark, can you speak to that at all? I know you're not an attorney again, but...
Sure, I can try. So I think that it raises a really interesting question. So in some respects, the Windsor case does involve, as was described at the top of the show...
The Proposition 8 case.
The Defense of Marriage Act.
Oh, forgive me. Yes, I'm sorry.
The Defense of Marriage Act case involves a question of income taxes and money that was due and owing to the federal government. So in that sense, it seems exactly as the caller is describing as a case that's about financial benefits. But as Justice Ginsburg's point was, I think, suggesting, there are very important respects in which it's not simply about financial benefits that either the challenge in the Federal Defense of Marriage Act case or in the Proposition 8 case involves. It's about social and political and legal equality and the ways in which same-sex and cross-sex couples are being treated under law, including for economic or financial purposes, but much more broadly than that.
Tim, does that answer your question?
It does, but I'm just, does it, as far as like political lines of concerns for those who are conservative or those who are liberal, would this give the federal government more money or have or make the federal government give more money? Hello?
Hello, I think we're both kind of...
No, so I don't know. I think it's a great question. I don't offhand know. I'm sure we can look it up and try to figure it out, although sort of probably not quickly enough to be able to give the caller an answer on air. But on the question of what the financial consequences are, one of the things that did come up during the oral arguments, though, that I think may speak to this question, is that the economic consequences are where matters of equality are concerned. Are ordinarily not thought to be the thing that should drive the question of whether there's a constitutional right to engage in some activity or not to engage in some activity, or to put it differently, whether the federal government may or may not discriminate. The economic justification, such as it is ordinarily not thought to be, certainly where there is heightened judicial scrutiny, is not ordinarily thought to be an adequate answer.
Demsis, thanks for the call. We do have to move on. Have quite a few callers on the line. We have Heather from Cleveland with another question about DOMA. Heather, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I have my question is, if the Supreme Court does favor into gay marriage, and I know with federal laws that it's all across all the states, will it change the fact that the states that don't have gay marriage, will you still be able to get married?
So the way that the arguments in the case involving the Federal Defense of Marriage Act are currently being structured are along the following lines. May the federal government have a different definition of marriage for same-sex couples than it does for cross-sex couples. But ordinarily, the federal rules here do not define what marriage is for purposes of state law. So the thought in the case one of the operating assumptions as the cases are being debated is the question here is not whether the federal government can or should be setting the parameters for what kinds of marriages the states must recognize, but rather whether the federal government can set different rules for same-sex and cross-sex couples for its own purposes. Does that answer the question?
Not really. Basically, like, if they pass it, because I'm gay, would I be able to get married in Ohio?
So the question of whether you would be able to get married in Ohio, again, going back to one of the earlier questions, depends on how the Supreme Court answers the constitutionality decides the constitutionality of either Prop 8 or the Federal Defense of Marriage Act or both. There are ways in which the court could rule in the cases that would have absolutely no effect on the status of same-sex marriage under Ohio law, but there are also ways in which the court could rule in both of the cases that could have implications for the state of Ohio.
Okay.
Heather, thanks so much for your call. Again, we're talking with Mark Spindleman, a professor from Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. We were expecting to speak with John Eastman from the National Organization for Marriage. That's a group opposed to gay marriage. John is not with us for some reason. We're not quite sure why, but we're going to continue the discussion. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, the phone number to call, 614-292-8513. And we have Don calling from Hamilton County. Don, thanks for your call.
Howdy. I had a question. You were referring to kids before and whether or not a gay marriage could produce kids. And I was thinking of the other possibility of kids being adopted into a homosexual grouping. And in that case, most of the time, those kids have come from a heterosexual union, and
at least a heterosexual couple.
Okay,
sure.
And they would not be at all used to this sort of a new situation, and they probably wouldn't be interested in it, want to know more about it, or anything else too much about it, especially if they're not an adult. Now, an adult probably could deal with it and accept it or not as he cares to, but a child is forced into the situation without obviously any rights to have a divorce himself. So he's basically forced in the situation. I was wondering if your speaker could comment on how a kid would pull himself up by his bootstraps and learn to buck up under the situation and accept it when he's still a child.
So the question of children and the relationship of children to same-sex marriages came up in different ways during the oral arguments. Interestingly, the argument was made at one point, or the suggestion was made at one point by Justice Kennedy that there might be reasons to think that children of same-sex couples who are not allowed to marry, the same-sex couples are not allowed to marry, and that the children of those couples could be harmed by laws that do not give their parents the same legal rights, status, benefits, privileges, and obligations under law that straight couples receive.
I don't know if it's verified, but he threw out the figure 40,000 children.
It's a remarkable remarkable number for him, and part of what it was that Justice Kennedy was describing was a concern here that seems to run in a different direction, in the direction of saying that the needs and interests of children counsel in favor of recognizing marriage equality rather than has traditionally been the case against recognizing marriage equality. And part of the problem in the state of California was that, again, as I described before, Proposition 8 is a rule that operates against the backdrop of same-sex couples getting all of the same other rights, benefits, privileges, and having all the same other obligations as cross-sex marriages under state law. So the question of adoption in same-sex couples was just not an issue any different than the issue of would be for married straight couples.
Well, Don, thanks so much for your call. They used multiple examples as far as sterile couples. Justice Kagan used the example of a couple who might be over the age of 55 or over the age of 60 or 70. And that Charles Cooper, the attorney arguing for Proposition 8, had a hard time answering that question. He kind of dodged it.
So part of what was happening during the oral arguments, as those questions were coming out and those presses were happening, was that the justices seemed to be operating from an assumption that we're no longer in the universe that we were in constitutionally when the Supreme Court decided Bowers against Hardwick back in 1986, where traditional moral disapproval of same-sex relationships and of homosexuality was enough to carry the day legally, any kind of law discriminating against lesbians and gay men was and is concerned. So part of what's happening is that as those questions are coming in, the irrationalities of limiting marriage or saying that the purpose of marriage is procreation, well, if that's the reason, then what about non-procreative couples over a particular age? Those questions, which test the rationality in a very close and aggressive way, are questions that wouldn't have come up just a number of years ago. It would have been taken for granted that it was enough to say procreation is the purpose of marriage. Same-sex couples cannot procreate naturally, therefore they can properly be excluded, and that's an adequate justification. That's no longer it's no longer the case that it's obviously an adequate justification, even though a number of courts have found that that's the reason and the definition of marriage, compared to arguments on the other side that say marriage is not about procreation, it's about the loving commitment of two consenting adults.
We do have quite a few callers on the line. Callers, hold the line. We're going to one other thing before we go to break. I do want to show the latest poll that I was able to find from Quinnipiac University, which is a pretty good polling institute. They're usually referred to as independent. American voters' support for same-sex marriage is inching up and now stands at 47% compared to 43% opposition, including a 54-38% margin among Catholic voters. So that does show how much this issue has come in just a few years. Just a decade, maybe. I mean, when was the first example of same-sex marriage? I believe it was the Netherlands in 2001.
There's no question that the issue has come in public opinion a tremendous distance in a remarkably short period of time, judged sort of over the long arc of history. But what's important to remember is, as much as public opinion polling shows shifts in attitudes in the American electorate, those shifts in attitudes in the American electorate have not yet fully been reflected in the pattern of state laws relating to marriage, including same-sex marriage. So it may not be the case that that we have a constitutional right to same-sex marriage until the pattern of laws catches up to where public opinion seems to be going.
Sure. We're talking about this week's Supreme Court arguments on gay marriage. We're joined by Mark Spindleman from Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. We were supposed to be joined by John Eastman this segment. He was not able to join us for some reason. Stay tuned. Coming up after the break, an advocate for same-sex marriage. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News, and we're streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
Rodney Crowell and Emmylou Harris have known each other for almost 40 years. He was in her band in the mid-70s, but they've just made their first full album as a duo. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them and hear their music. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins. And what it means to be a rural community in 2013 and how to ensure their futures. That discussion from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Expect sunshine for today. We'll reach a high near 50 degrees. Partly cloudy for tonight, dropping down to a low of 30. Mostly sunny with a high back up again near 50 for Friday. Sunshine on Saturday, too, with a high of 55. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance. In-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann. We're talking about this week's U.S. Supreme Court arguments on gay marriage. Still with us is Mark Spindleman from Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Last segment, we were supposed to be joined by John Eastman, a major opponent to same-sex marriage. He was not able to join us for some reason. With us now is Ian James. He's the co-founder of Freedom Ohio. That's the organization that aims to amend the Ohio State Constitution to allow same-sex marriage. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thanks, Steve. I was hoping we'd see John Eastman here today.
He was supposed to be able to phone. Not sure why he... I'm not sure why he wasn't able to join us.
His battery went dead.
I'm not sure why. Either way, where does your petition drive stand?
Well, of course, we were certified by the Attorney General, approved by the ballot board unanimously, survived a Supreme Court challenge last year. We've been collecting for the better part of a year now. We'll qualify in 50 counties plus. You have to qualify in 44. We'll have the number of signatures necessary to qualify by the filing deadline for this year, which is July the 3rd. But that's not a guarantee that we'll file.
Is there one petition drive or are there multiple?
There's only one.
Okay. Were you happy with the arguments made by attorneys for Edith Windsor and the lesbian couple from California? Do you think they made a good legal case?
I think that the case that was put forward was really good. I didn't really have a whole lot of time to focus on what was going on in the Supreme Court, frankly, because I think, as Marcus said, it's not going to directly impact Ohio. And we've been focused solely on making sure that we get the amendment on the ballot and passed so that loving couples sort of have the ability to care for and protect each other, especially in a time of crisis.
And it's really hard to separate personal feelings and legalese in this matter. But from a legal standpoint, why is the ban on same-sex marriage wrong and or unconstitutional?
Well, marriage is the best way to care for and protect a couple and their families, from child care to hospitalization to property rights, probate. I mean, we're all going to die. Eventually, we're all going to die. And that's really what Windsor's case is about, is death and property conveyance and taxes. So when you're treating someone differently than another just because of their gender, that's wrong. If it's not fair, it's not equal. And so we're just trying to make it equal across the board for everybody.
And we do have John Eastman on the line who was able to join us. John, are you there?
I am.
Hi, John. What about you? What were your thoughts on the Supreme Court arguments, if you can speak to each case specifically, the Proposition 8 arguments and then the DOMA arguments? Were you happy with the legal case that the attorneys made?
I certainly was. And I think, you know, the entire process should be commended here. The justices were obviously taking these cases very seriously. The attorneys were extremely well prepared. I think the jurisdictional questions, which the justices have to address because they're serious and fairly novel. But I think at the end of the day, the court finds that they have jurisdiction in both cases. The proponents of Proposition 8 clearly represent the interests of the state of California and have been deputized to do so by the California Supreme Court interpreting the California Constitution. So that should be definitive there. And in the Defense of Marriage Act, when the Attorney General of the United States refuses to defend a statute, the Supreme Court has previously specifically said that the Congress, and in this case the House of Representatives, has the authority to intervene to defend those statutes. Otherwise, a president could effectively veto laws after the fact just unilaterally, and that's not what our system is. So I think they're going to reach the merits of both cases. And then the question is, you know, does it violate equal protection to continue to have traditional marriage? And that's the question I think the court's going to grapple with. And it's a very close question. You look at the questions from the justices, it's probably a very evenly divided court, 5-4 or at most 6-3, one way or the other.
John Eastman, when listening to the Proposition 8 arguments, Charles Cooper made the contention that marriage's main purpose is to further procreation. The court, specifically Justice Kagan, did her best to punch holes in that argument, or at least to challenge it. Did you have any concerns with Cooper's main contention that marriage is to further procreation?
Not at all. It's the reason government gets involved in the marriage business. There are lots of other reasons that government might find some benefits for marriage, as your earlier guest was pointing out. But the principal reason is this is the institution that is developed in every single society across human history to channel the unique procreative functions of men and women into a socially beneficial institution, because that's the one that provides the stability necessary for the proper and good upbringing of children.
You know, that's going to be a surprise to my mom. Let's see. And,
John,
this is going to be a surprise to my mom.
Talking.
My mom is married. Married. She's 70-something years old. She's 70-something years old. She gets remarried to a wonderful man. It has nothing to do with procreation.
Interrupt me.
But let's do our best.
Just stating a point, John.
Let's do our best not to talk over each other. John Eastman, again, Charles Cooper was posed with the question, should sterile couples or should couples who are beyond the age of procreation be allowed to marry? What do you think about that?
Chuck made a very wise point, and Justice Kagan, I thought, inappropriately made light of it. He pointed out that the reason we have the institution of marriage is not just to produce children within that institution, and obviously people that are past, where women are past the age of childbearing would no longer produce children within that institution, but Chuck pointed out that's typically not true of the man. And the institution of marriage, the cultural sanctions that go along with it are designed not only to produce children within the institution, but to prevent the production of children wherever possible outside of that institution, and because societal harms often flow from that, and the social science evidence on this is profoundly significant. Children do much better in a married being raised by married parents of a man and a father than they do in every other kind of thing. Now there are all sorts of exceptions to that, but when you're looking society wide. What's the best way to benefit society from this unique procreative ability of men and women? That's the institution we have, and we ought not to be watering it down.
I think the American Medical Association disagrees with you in some research, or at least released a study last week that hinted that was not solely the case, at least.
Well, that's right. But, you know, there's a lot of agenda-driven science going on here, which is another travesty of this thing. But if you look at the 2011 HHS study done by the Obama administration's Health and Human Services Department on family structures, it reaches that conclusion, and I think that's pretty significant.
It seems that your position is lagging behind the American public, at least in regard to polling. Again, a Quinnipiac University poll, which is usually referred to as a good independent polling institute, says American voters' support for same-sex marriage is inching up and now stands at 47% approval compared to 43% opposition. So it seems like that the American people are slowly agreeing with you less.
Well, that's exactly where this debate ought to be had, in the court of public opinion. Let's debate this. There are very serious issues here. Is redefining marriage going to have harm or benefit for society? Nobody knows. Let's have some states experiment with it. And if we find out there are huge harms to society, the rest of the country won't have to suffer those harms before we switch back. If there are no harms for society, the rest of the country can learn from that lesson as well. But that's what the political process is. And what we don't want is the Supreme Court to step in and say, you know, somehow, magically, 150 years ago, the Constitution already answered this question, and we just are now figuring it out. That would shut the debate off at the moment of its highest point of contention. And quite frankly, just like it did 40 years ago with Roe versus Wade, it would lock it in that point, and we would be at pitched battle lines for the foreseeable future.
John, we did have the program scheduled in a pretty specific way, so I'm going to have one more question for you. I've heard the suggestion many times that completely abolishing the legal definition of marriage and then giving everyone civil unions and then leaving marriage up to the churches, and that would preserve religious freedom and also give legal equality. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's certainly an option people in the states might want to choose. Although I will say this, it completely divorces the reason government was involved in the marriage business in the first place, and that would further weaken the institution. Look, if there is something uniquely significant about the procreative abilities of men and women that pose unique risks and offer unique benefits to society, then we have an interest for society to stay involved in that institution. And if we completely take ourselves out of that business, we may well lose the benefits of society. The Supreme Court has called marriage a fundamental basic right because it is essential to the survival of society. We may lose that if we take government out of the business altogether.
Well, John Eastman is the chairman of the board for the National Organization for Marriage, a group that opposes same-sex marriage. John, thanks for calling in this morning.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay, all the best. Ian, I'm sure you have quite a few strong feelings about the things John said, but as far as keeping with the legalese and the legal definition of marriage, John makes the case that it's important to stay with the definition or at least the perception of marriage that we've had for thousands of years, whereas we have about a 12-year history worldwide with same-sex marriage.
Well, in 2004, the Ohio voters defined marriage as being between a man and a woman and said that you can't have anything that looks like, smells like, feels like marriage. There's no civil union ability. And so, you know, that's the law of Ohio, and that's what we're overturning with this petition, so that people can actually get married, so they can best care for themselves, so they can best care for their families, so that they are able to deal with crises as they arise. And so, you know, John's entitled to his opinion, no matter how wrong he is, as my grandmother used to say. I think it's interesting that it's about procreation when, as I said before, my mom's in her 70s, marries a wonderful man. They're not going to have kids, but they're married. They're married at the church. All we're saying is let people that want to be able to be married, and that's what the amendment does, Freedom to Marry and Religious Freedom Amendment, is let people that want to be married get married at the courthouse. And if you are a house of worship, then you have the right to say whether or not you're going to recognize or perform a marriage. But you don't have the right to then say, hey, you gay couple, cannot go to the courthouse and be married. Nor can you say, as a house of worship, you can't go to an affirming house of worship and be married. So that is the truest sense of separation, and that is a true sense of respect and protect and freedom that you come to. And that's why, frankly, 54% of Ohioans are supporting this amendment right now.
Mark Spindelman from the Moritz College of Law, getting back to John Eastman's arguments, yeah. Are those pretty typical of the, as far as the legal arguments against same-sex marriage?
Sure. You know, part of the question here is whether for constitutional purposes, certainly we're not for political purposes, but whether for constitutional purposes, we're in a sense trapped by what may have been the motives for marriage at some point in time. But what the Supreme Court's decisions involving marriage in recent years have pointed out is that this is an individual autonomy right. That is the right of an individual to marry. It's not conditioned. I mean, as one of the justices pointed out during oral arguments, one of the main cases involving the constitutional right to marry is a case involving the right of prisoners to be free from restrictions on their liberty that would have precluded them from getting married. Now, they weren't talking about conjugal visits. And the idea was that these are rights that individual adults have under the U.S. Constitution. And that's in conflict with the view that he's taking about the constitutional purposes of marriage. And they're just, there's a conflict of views on this, whether it's about procreation, if it's about procreation, what do we do about those instances in which people cannot procreate? And on the other side, that it's not, marriage is not about procreation essentially as a constitutional matter. It's about individual choice and individual liberty, or it related to that, equality.
We're talking about gay marriage and the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News. Still with us is Mark Spindleman from Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. We're also with Ian James. He's the co-founder of Freedom Ohio. That's an organization that looks to amend the Ohio State Constitution to allow same-sex marriage. And Ian, I suppose it would be a good problem to have, but what would you do if the Supreme Court struck down Ohio's ban? Then your effort goes away.
Well, that's not being decided right now, so I don't think that's even possible.
I mean, if they could reach it, I suppose there would be a very, very small chance they could reach any kind of wide-ranging
it's
decision.
It's so small that you would need an electron microscope to see it.
The question I just put before John Eastman, I've heard a lot of people make the suggestion, abolish the legal definition of marriage, give everyone civil unions, and leave marriage up to the churches.
And this is the one place I think this is going to come as a shock to everybody. I agree with John Eastman that I think that you create all kinds of problems, because then, you know, let's say that Mark and I get civil unioned, and then we're going out and we're saying, okay, we are civil union. Well, what the heck does that even mean? I mean, we are at a hospital, we've been civil unioned, and the doctor is saying, hey, look, I'm a trauma surgeon, dude. I don't know what that even pertains to. But if you say we're married, then all of a sudden it's like, okay, I have the authority and the right to make decisions right now. And that trauma surgeon says, boom, I get it. So, you know, there are some real problems with civil union versus marriage. Plus,
in Ohio, some states have very clear definitions of civil union.
Right. In Ohio, certainly in Ohio, you're forbidden from having that. But again, it's also the separate and unequal, right? It is not the same. There is holy matrimony. You go to a church, you go to a house of worship, and there is civil marriage. So if you're going to get married and you want to go to a courthouse, you should be free to do that. I think there's also part of the reason we got rid of common law marriage in Ohio is because, you know, the government couldn't figure out who was married and who wasn't. You live together for 10 years out in the wilderness, and, you know, what does that mean? What paperwork do you have? You get married in a civil marriage. You spend $45 to get a marriage license. You go to a marriage officiant who pays $10 to the Secretary of State. You get married, and that paperwork is filed with the probate court.
Mark Spindleman, in closing, I'll give you the last comment. What do you expect the Supreme Court to do? Do you have any predictions at all?
There's a pretty famous Harvard Law professor by the name of Lawrence Tribe, who famously argued the Bowers against Hardwick case. I think of him often these days when I'm asked this question. Famously, he commented, "He who lives by the crystal ball is bound to eat a lot of ground glass." I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you know, I think that there were lots of high hopes on the pro same-sex marriage side going into these arguments. A lot of real concerns and fears on the other side. I think what you see coming out of the argument is a court that, as John Eastman said, is proceeding very cautiously, carefully, and it remains to be seen. What seems clear is that the court's going to be in the marriage business for a while.
We'll have to keep an eye on the court's decision. Mark Spindleman is a professor at OSU's Moritz College of Law, and Ian James is with Freedom Ohio, the group that hopes to legalize same-sex marriage in Ohio. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.